Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
On this episode of Damsels in the DMs,
I always feel like there's no investment in self that you can make that can go wrong. Because even if it doesn't pay off for that particular project, it will for others.
This message is intended as a reminder that we are not licensed professionals, not psychiatrists or psychologists. If you have a serious problem, please seek professional help. The National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255.
There's some damsels in the DM.
Yes, queen.
Tell us what's the vibe. There's some damsels in the DM. Please tell us what's the vibe. DMs, DMs, yeah, we see them. Yeah, we read them. DMs, DMs, we don't need them. We just leave them.
Please.
Yeah.
It's going down in the DMs. Bye.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Damsels in the DMs. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Alejandro.
Alejandro, you were on set all weekend as a producer. Tell us.
Oh my God, it was so much fun. So I was on the production side of Cuddles, which is written and directed by Andrew Lara Cervantes, who also wrote El Marihuano. And while I wasn't able to act in a lead role, he was gracious enough to give me a little cameo spot where I got to play the security check-in person. So I was serving, if Cardi B were in Reno 911, that was the energy that I was channeling for my character as I let one of the lead
characters. How did you come up with that?
It was super last minute when he was like, hey, we should have you do a little cameo and maybe you'll like check the person is as the check-in person. So immediately I'm just like, okay, what do I have? What do I wear? And then I was trying to think, like, what is my motivation? What is my character thinking? And for some reason, those two things came to mind. And because I didn't have any lines, I knew I needed to do something with my face to emote something when the character passed with the little camera time that I had. So, yeah, those were my sources of inspiration for doing what I needed to do. How have you been?
I have been good. I was just going to tell you that you are an artist in everything that you do. You've been playing the cashier.
I love it.
No, I've been good. I'm back in school and I actually just started writing again, my second feature film.
Yes.
It's crazy. So we did 90 pages on the first one last year and now we're right back at it with my new idea. And, you know, I thought I was all out of ideas, but it's amazing when you have to come up with an idea the way that you find something that you're into.
I love that. And what do you think are some of the most helpful tools that you've used in formulating like the full outline and like jumping into writing the script or all of that?
Sure. So Columbia makes us do something that I find super helpful, and it's called a sequencing assignment. And basically, you think about everything that's going to happen in your film and you break it up into 10 sequences. So if it's like the first sequence is Alejandro goes to the park, meets someone interesting, buys them a hot dog, that would be like a sequence. So you think about like, what are the 10 most important things that I'm trying to hit in this film, and you lay those out, and then that informs you when you go to write your script.
That is amazing. I absolutely love this. I was having a conversation with a friend yesterday who was asking me for advice on like formatting for a screenplay, and I was like, okay, well, you want to think about the hinges in the story, like the major points, but this 10 sequence bit sounds like such a valuable tool. That's amazing.
Yeah, I feel like it's really hard just to sit down. So I also just recommend like setting deadlines for yourself. That's one of the things that I think Columbia did so well for me, or just like, you know, was worth all the money in taking it on, just because like it's somebody to hold you accountable to actually getting the work done. And at least for me, like without those pretty strict deadlines, I'm not the best at self-motivating for work that's like just to elevate my career.
Right. Well, speaking of meeting deadlines, I mean, Elaine Del Valle seems like the quintessential example of holding oneself accountable to not only, you know, goals that one wants to accomplish, but also every task required in between, right?
100%. I think when you are a director who's able to work under those really tight circumstances, it just shows that you can take on any kind of project. And I know Elaine just premiered one of her films for Tubi, which is a super interesting experience. And she talks a little bit about this episode, how working on that contest and working in those tight deadlines helped get her the job at Tubi, because she showed what she can do working in that type of fast pace, the stakes are high environment.
Absolutely. And we are huge fans of books here on the pod. So yes. To learn about how Brownsville Bread started as a book and then turned into a film, that was also really exciting. So I'm so pumped that she had some time in her busy schedule to come on the podcast and share with us about a little bit about her journey. And yeah, it's exciting.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So for everyone listening, Elaine and I actually met at the Bentonville Film Festival when I was there with How to Hack Birth Control. And I was immediately taken with Elaine's ability to sort of be a jack of all trades. You started as an actor, moved into casting, now you're directing. I think our listeners just want to hear about how it all began. I know a lot of that is depicted in your journey, Brownsville Bread, which is the film that you were promoting when I met you. So please just take us through.
Sure. Yes, I started as an actor and I became very frustrated at the lack of opportunities for myself as a Latina actress. And I began writing. I had been studying under Wynne Handman at Carnegie Hall, professional scene studies for a number of years. And over the summer hiatus, I started a writer's group out of my class. And when we got back to class, I just started putting what I was writing on its feet. I didn't even know what it was. But Wynne told me that I must keep writing it. And I did. And it became a one-woman show. And although I had been super frustrated at the lack of opportunities, like the great parts that I was longing to play, I had plenty of opportunities in the commercial market. So I was like a commercial queen. I had been on so many national Spanish language, English language commercials and voiceovers. I was doing financially very well. So everyone who I invited to the show was everyone that I had known, period, including people from the industry that I had worked with, including people from the commercial industry. And it was there that a commercial producer saw the play and thought that he knew me until he saw the play. Then he was like, wow, I want to work with you every single day, but I can't hire an actor every day. So what else do you do? And I just said, what do you need? And actually it was his idea, casting. And I said, I'll try it. Because by that time I had been in like every single commercial casting office in New York. And I knew what the experience was like from an actor standpoint. I knew what it was like to book the room and to be with the client at the end of the day. I took my shot and it was very successful. And then I'm a techie, so I learned the casting platforms pretty quickly as soon as they became available to me. And I've been casting ever since. So I still cast, even though I also direct. But from the acting came the writing. From that one-woman show came the opportunity to work with, to earn money in this industry and work a parallel track in the industry, earning money while still pursuing everything that I already was pursuing. And then with the writing came just more opportunity. More people, as they saw the show, wanted to get to know my writing more, my voice. I started to actually value my own voice and realize that there weren't a lot of people like me out there or telling the stories that I was telling. I'm a girl originally from the ghetto projects of Brownsville, Brooklyn. And these were the stories that I was telling. And people were like starving for them.
Yeah. I love this. And what I really admire is the fact that you are so open to exploring these different talents and passions that you have, but how one lends itself to another in a really beautiful, overlapping way. But for writers out there who might be struggling to find their voice or who are kind of hitting their head against a brick wall, what kind of advice would you have in terms of just overcoming those obstacles or overcoming a writer's block where they might be struggling to really like harness their voice?
There's a saying that goes right, what, right? Yeah. So definitely start there, because your perspective is yours and yours alone. It's the same uniqueness that you have as an actor. What you bring to a character is also what you bring as a writer. And then, just like in acting, there's this natural innate talent that you might have, a raw talent, but then there's also craft that you can study. So I do believe that I inhabit both. I have a natural talent, but I also believe that without the craft behind what I'm doing, I wouldn't be as successful as I am today in both acting as well as in writing and anything that I do. I would say study craft. I took classes first. I took writing classes with Sundance Institute, and they really taught us how to get over, or at least help us with, writer's block. They taught how to adapt stories, what was important. I already knew from scene study what was important, but in terms of creating a film out of these stories that I was having, that was something that I needed, maybe because they were so truthful, so raw, so honest, because I was so going, that was actually the thing that was hurting me most in exploring the story. And it wasn't until at the Sundance Institute, Kimberly Pierce, who did Boys Don't Cry, said, if you're going after a true story, you need to just forget about the truth and follow the emotional truth and the action. Because the emotional truth is far more interesting than the actual mundane everyday life truth. So just create for screen. And then there were other exercises like, here's a visual image. Now create a story with this visual image using your character. And it really frees you from your plans. And it lets you just vomit out that, that thing that you need to get out. And then you start to hone it.
The one thing that I've always loved about you is your ability to let imposter syndrome, which is something that a lot of women struggle with, sort of fall to the wayside and just trust that you'll be able to handle whatever new endeavor you take on. How do you do that? And how do you trust that you'll be okay when you come out the other side?
Experience, right? In acting, the experience was actually taking the stage, right? And you cannot fake that. And when I was doing my play, I did it thousands of times. And one woman show, 90 minutes. It was a lot of responsibility, a lot of fear. I used to dream about losing my lines, right? But what I came to understand about myself is that once I got on the stage, everything disappeared and I was able to make it work. So the more I did that, the more I was able to trust that. I also feel like that with improv. I was taking improv classes at two places, the People's Improv Theater, as well as Upright Citizens Brigade, the long Harold format. I did it with a group. And then every time we were in rehearsals, I always felt like I was I sucked. I was the worst one. I always felt like everyone else was getting these great ideas during rehearsals, but I was always feeling stuck during the, rehearsals. But then when showtime came, whenever there was a show, something happened that just my performances always exploded. And then the more you do it, the more that happens, the more you begin to realize that's a pattern that you can depend on. So that for acting, for sure, that for stepping up to the plate. And when it's time, you know that you're going to deliver. That's just a comp that I developed. But then also, outside of this industry, something that I would do all the time, I did it for 13 years actually, is I organized a charity event. I wanted to help a school for children with autism that my husband and I had founded. And someone said to me one day that they were riding their bicycle for AIDS and that they were looking for a donation from me for AIDS. Now, my dad had died of AIDS. So I knew that I was gonna give this person everything in my wallet. But I was more interested in connecting with them in terms of what is it about AIDS that makes you want to raise money for it. And the cyclist said to me, I don't know anyone with AIDS. I just want to ride my bicycle in this event and I have to raise money for it. And I feel proud about it. So when he said that, I was like, wow, this is a thing that I can tap into in order to help this school for kids with autism that, won me over and stole my heart and these kids in need and the families in need. So I thought to myself, wow, I'm going to create a cycling event to help these kids with autism. And I did it for 13 years, and we had over 1,000 riders. We did it over 62 miles on the streets of Long Island without closing them down. Had to mark the streets, get all the food donated, the insurance donated, mark it out to the riders, just everything that needed to happen logistically for that event. Now that, over the course of 13 years, that really made me a great producer. We talk about things in the industry, but it's really that that made me so confident. So now, compared to that, honestly, producing a movie is nothing. Because you got to do everything, the permitting, the insurance, the food, the people, the signups, the waivers, everything that a movie needs, this cycling event needed, even behind the scenes photography, everything. So that really built my confidence in being able to make movies and follow through on things. And that's it.
I'm curious, what was the decision to start the school with your husband?
The school is called ASCENT, A-S-C-E-N-T, ASCENT, a school for individuals with autism. It's still around. It's in Deer Park. And the cycling event that I created was called the Mansion Ride for Autism. And I think it was in our fourth year that we were named one of the most interesting and successful charity rides in the United States by Bicycling Magazine, which is a national publication. And the thing is I don't even know how to ride a bike. So I wasn't even like into cycling or anything. I was just into like raising the money. And I have raised over $1 million for the school over the years. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, now you see what I was saying, Alejandra, when I said a true jack of all trades.
It's the same thing, right? You're just raising money for something that you believe in. I wish I was as successful at that in film than I was at the cycling event. And for that matter, when I actually produce others as well, I feel like when I'm talking about my own stuff, it feels so selfish. But when I'm doing it for others, it feels so selfless that the no's don't matter. And I've taken that lesson, like the no's shouldn't matter. You need to be able to accept the no and move on and not let that no discourage you. It just needs to, you know, you just have to move on. And writing grants, I used to write grants for the school all the time and win them. So writing grants for the school, then I just started writing grants for film and I would get those as well. Of course, not as often as I was like, but yeah, it's tough. It's tough making films, but mostly the tough part of it is mostly the financial part of it. And then the second tough part of it for me, sentimentally, is the responsibility of everyone who I feel is there because of me, because they're fulfilling my vision as a director. And that's the best feeling in the world as a director, but it also brings on all this, you know, I got to make sure everybody's well fed, right down to craft services. I want everyone to feel appreciated and motivated, inspired, all of that stuff.
I have a friend who says, let others tell you no, but never tell yourself no. Like, just to not wait. No, I try to stick with that, but as a people pleaser, it's something that I struggle with, but I always have it in my head. But speaking of making movies, I want to go back to Brownsville Bread, which I saw before I even had met you, and I was automatically like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I know that you've been filming something else in addition to that was taken from Brownsville Bread. So tell us all about how you had the idea originally, what the process looked like. I know it started as a book, and then now what you've been doing with it.
Right. So it went from a one-woman stage play. I adapted it into a novel and it was successful as a novel. It's being taught in schools now. And then as a filmmaker, I just wanted to adapt this as a film. So I had gotten a grant. Let me pull it back a little bit. I'd been making films for about, I guess, since 2013, I started making films, directing them, producing them, writing them. And every year I was committed that I was going to make a film no matter what. Like I would just save up money and use all that money at the end of the year to make at least one film. And so that's what I was doing. I started with a web series and I always knew that I wanted to adapt Brownsville Bread as a film, but I wanted to also explore other things, other people's material, adapting other people's material. So the first film that I really had great success with was Me 3.769. It landed, it was a short film that landed on HBO through acquisition, through winning a festival. And then the next film that I did was a film called Princess Cut. Which also, it won the HBO Latinx Short Film Director Award and all kinds of festivals. And it also was acquired by HBO. So that was super cool. And then with, I knew I wanted to make Brownsville Bread, but I knew it was going to take more. So I started applying for grant opportunities, and I got on the radar of an organization called the 150 Foundation, which at the time was put together by WarnerMedia. And they gave a grant to make Brownsville Bread. Now, it wasn't enough money to make the film, the whole film. So I decided that I was going to make a portion of it and then put that on the festival circuit as a pilot. Now, as an aside, I kind of need to go back to say that same year that I got that grant, I always continued writing and taking classes. And I wrote a pilot having nothing to do with Brownsville Bread called The System. That pilot actually landed in development and I sold it to CBS, the network. So I pitched it. I had a showrunner and everything, and it sold. So coming off of the what I felt was the greatest achievement of my entire career, selling a pilot to CBS, getting paid so much to write my own material, that was amazing for me. And I wanted to just make sure that I wasn't going to lose that trajectory. So the Brownsville Bread opportunity, when I only had enough to make a small portion, it was a no-brainer to me that I would make that into what I would call a pilot. And that's what I ended up going into the festival circuit with Brownsville Bread. And then what you're talking about now in terms of the continuation of filming more, if you consider the first part of Brownsville Bread a pilot that I did on a very low budget, now I've gone on to do a part two now that I just got in the can under a micro budget SAG agreement. So it wasn't something that I had to get permission for. Those things are allowed. And I filmed another portion of it, and I expect to film another portion of it and another portion of it until it's done. And it's my way. I can't afford to afford my entire vision in one shot. So because it's a coming of age story, I get to do it over a course of time and take advantage of the SAG micro budget and consider it as if they're a series. And then I'll see when I'm done putting it together if it does maintain the series vibe or if it becomes a feature film. But yeah, I'm not going to release any more until I'm done filming because it's too much money to go into the edit and everything again and again and again. I'd rather wait until the end. And in the meantime, I'm just editing myself.
So your plan is eventually, would you sell the entire series to somebody or if it turns into a feature?
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that I'm going to recoup the investment that I'm making in myself. But even if I don't, I always feel like there's no investment in self that you can make that can go wrong. Because even if it doesn't pay off for that particular project, it will for others. For example, I actually just directed another feature film that I was just hired to direct that's going to premiere on Tubi. What's today? Wednesday? Tomorrow. It premieres tomorrow and I filmed it over the summer and I did it. I got the opportunity because, you know, I'd been making films. Remember I said I always wanted to make a film every year and Brownsville, I continued to save up for. I became a Shirt Atlas supported artist whereby I could let people donate to me and it's a 501c3 tax deductible donation to support the film. But still, I didn't want to spend all of that on anything else but Brownsville. But I knew that I had to keep making films. So I did something as part of the Women's Weekend Film Challenge, which is an organization where they gather groups of women, they create teams, choose director, actors, writers, producers, and say, okay, this is your team. Now we're going to draw a genre out of a hat. And this weekend, you will make the movie Soup to Nuts, writing to post-production and done and deliver. And I was chosen as a director. It was a film called All Is Well. Our genre was, dystopian drama.
Ooh.
We turned it into a climate change drama and we were given three actors. They were all women. So we created this thing and the movie was looking pretty good. And then someone saw that through a film festival that was an executive producer at a major production company. And they said, we want to meet that filmmaker who made that film in these amount of days. We want to meet that person. So we met. And by the end of our meeting, I was like, oh my goodness, if you like that movie, you have got to see Princess Cut, which I also did actually over a weekend. I did it in one weekend, but it was a lot like, you know, my prep was longer and it was everything that I wanted. It wasn't really too much of a collaboration. The other film was, but it was like all my vision and really going after that story. And then I said it was on HBO. So she got off of our Zoom meeting, went on to HBO. It must have been immediately, because 25 minutes later, the time that it took to watch the film, she reached out to me and said, I just saw Princess Cut. I love it. And we're definitely going to be working together. That was on a Tuesday. On a Friday, she reached out to me and said, there's a project coming up that we think that you're a good match for. We need you to pitch it. I was like, I'd love to pitch it, but you have to be available in May. So this was like just now. This is like just now. In like April, I met with her and I had to be available in May. And that Friday, they gave me the pitch opportunity. I said, I need the script. And then that weekend, I worked on a pitch deck. I made it even a visual pitch deck and everything, and took advantage of the fact that I knew great actors that might be able to work in this, and, you know, really showed my vision in like a 10-page deck. And I met with them on that Monday. And then Tuesday, they hired me. Jeez. And within 2 weeks, I was directing a feature film that will now premiere on Tubi tomorrow.
That is incredible. Yeah. Oh my God. Congratulations. This is.
Yes. So thank you for that. Yes.
When you were first talking about how they were formulating the teams, I was like, you didn't tell them you could just do all parts of the team?
Well, no, actually, all parts of the team, that is a part of the Women's Weekend Film Challenge, which I think is called Moonshot now, but that is a part that you have to agree to do anything. So I was like, yeah, I could produce, write, cast, I could act, I could direct, and then you have to give them your reels of everything. So I gave them my directing reel, and I think that's what really impressed them, that I could definitely do this. And the film was a success. You know, I wish I had more time, but it was a great experience, and I love the outcome of, like, I love visually what I was able to create with my team. And I love the fact that no one was getting paid. We did it on a $200 budget. And we were extraordinarily resourceful. I'm very resourceful, let me say. I'm like, what is there to use? And then I like just try to implement it. And then that creates the greater production value. So I'm not the director that's going to be like, I must have color, you know, number M323 of the red. I must have that. I'm like, no, show me the reds. Okay, that's the one that I'll choose. So I'm very nimble in that way, or like, show me the locations. Okay, somebody has a restaurant. Great, we're going to make it a restaurant scene. Oh my God, this person's going to give us the ability to use this studio and we're going to make it into a train. Hey, riders, first scene, they're on a train, they're going somewhere. They're going somewhere, it's to save their lives. And guess what? We have like a bush over here and I have this room over there. That's what creates fast, expedient, easy to move through, production. Yeah, all of that. So yeah, I go off on tangents, but you see how everything is connected.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Adaptability is so crucial. And I love the confidence with which you move. I'm curious, through that experience, was there anything that surprised you about the process or that you learned?
I'm always surprised about a lot of things in every single category, and I'm always learning. I'm an avid learner. I'll ask you, what are you talking about? Like, are you talking about from the feature film, what did I learn? Brownsville Bread, what did I learn? The, you know, the Women's Weekend Film Challenge, what did I learn? Which is it? Because I'm learning all the time.
Well, I love that. No, we are always talking about how important it is to be learning at every project and every conversation. But in Brownsville Bread, but also, yeah, this tight turnaround of a filmmaking process, like that sounds, it sounds like you're just like flying by the edge of your seat.
Well, with a tight turnaround, honestly, I didn't feel like it was a tight turnaround because I always make films fast because I can't afford to do them long, right? I have to do them fast. So like Princess Cut, even though I had so much prep, the turnaround was still this turnaround. The editing, I usually take my time with editing, but remember, they put together the team. So they gave me the editor. The editor fulfilled her thing. We even had original score. I am very decisive. You know, you give me options, I'm going to say yes or no to these options. But there are lots of things that I'm always learning from. But that particular experience, I guess I wish I had the editor on set. But it's still not something that I can always do. Like, I tried for my editor to be on set for this portion of Brownsville Bread, but the editor was not on set. And then, you know, the sound and the camera person, even though we had done a pre-production meeting, they didn't check in with one another. Or I don't know where it was off, but what happened was that this go round, we didn't record scratch sound. So the dailies needed to be done because the camera that we used, the Arri Alexa, doesn't do automatic dailies like the Sony Venice does. So we didn't have scratch audio. So now I had to create the dailies. And now I have to sync sound. But the problem with syncing sound is that if you edit in Final Cut, you have to use one program. If you edit in Premiere, you have to use another program. I'm not sure who's other than me. I can edit in both. I can edit in Final Cut as well as Premiere. But I don't know who's going to be the final person doing the final edit. And so I'd have to just do both things. So we should have recorded scratch audio. And so that's something that I learned. But I mean, I'm learning all the time.
I'm in post on my project now and just thinking about the fact that you're also editing your own project. I'm like, oh my God, you truly do it all, because I think I would be lost.
Well, not because I want to, but I think that it actually inures to the filmmaker's benefit if they have time. I think it inures to your benefit to actually edit your own films, because that's the only way that you're going to really learn.
It's true.
How the transitions are going to work. And directing has so much to do with the transitions and flow. And I'm always thinking about that, how it's going to cut, how it's going to transition, making sure that I keep the line. And I think that editing, you know, it's like the way to learn your mistakes on such a unique level that you'll never make those mistakes again. And I think you learn more from mistakes than you do from your triumphs.
So true.
And the mistakes of others. You can learn from the mistakes of others as well. They don't all have to be your own mistakes.
I want to go back to when you were talking about the pitch deck that you created for the project that you did almost overnight, it sounds like. You mentioned that you drew from the actors who you had met as a casting director. And I think probably every actor who's listening to this podcast right now is like, oh my God, how do I get on Elaine's radar? So please tell us, how do you get on Elaine's radar as an actor, and how do people really catch your eye when you're casting?
Let me say this. I'm always looking, even when I'm not casting. I always consider it my job to be looking for talent. So whether I'm at a festival, if I'm just watching television, if I'm watching stuff for meetings, I have a lot of meetings with like studios and networks and showrunners now, because I'm being considered to direct for television and other things. When I have those meetings, I do as much research as I possibly can to know what they're covering. What are the shows that they're covering? How do those shows work? Who's on it? So I'm watching a lot. I consider it my job to watch, but then I also just enjoy watching. I just love watching film and television. Like, I love it. I would do it if it wasn't my job. So that's how to get on my radar. But then I get invitations all the time to like shows. And then even if I don't go to a show, maybe I'll send someone, and then someone will come back to me and say, that was a really good actor. I met them afterward. And then I'll consider them further for other things. And then so many times I'm auditioning people and I get the auditions and I love them, but they're just not right. Or like I'll see a play and I'll be like, I don't remember that person. And then as soon as something comes up, they might still be submitting themselves, but then when I submit them again, when they submit themselves again, I'm like, oh, I got to see this person 100%. And that's the story with the girl who actually booked the lead with Midnight Hustle, it's called, coming on Tubi tomorrow for free. It's free, so anybody can watch it. She actually, I saw her in a play called Hamlet in Harlem, and I loved her performance. I loved everyone's performance there. But she was a real standout to me. And I was like, I'm going to work with that girl one day. I don't know on what, but I know something. And then as a casting director, I was casting a movie called Born Astray by Adele Morales. And it was one of the recipients of the Spike Lee grant. Mm-hmm. And I think she had submitted, or maybe I reached out to her or whatever. She submitted, she got a part there. And then I asked Adele, how is the cast? How is everyone to work with? And he just kudos to her. She was great to work with, easy to work with. And then when I was looking for my cast for this movie, Midnight Hustle, now they gave me a casting director. So the EP said to me, we have a casting director on board. This is going to be your casting director. But knowing the tight turnaround, I did my research. I went into my own casting platforms and I wanted to see the parameters that were going to meet these people. I needed to find actresses that were on point. And if you remember, Lauren, I actually asked you. If you were a ballerina on point, because I thought that you would be a good candidate for that. Mm-hmm. So you were even someone that I thought of for that.
I'm one of the lucky ones on Elaine's radar.
So then here I am on my casting platform, looking on point, New York, Los Angeles. We could have flown anyone from anywhere. And here pops up this actress again. And I was like, this incredible actor that I love so much already and want to work with already, and I see her star potential, is also an on-point ballerina, which is perfect for this part. So I made sure that she was going to audition. I gave the casting director a list of actors that I felt were right for it, including her and including the second lead, which is played by Savoy Bailey, who has very little acting experience, actually. But I saw her because I was interviewing with Shondaland, Shonda Rhimes' organization company, to direct for television there. And I wanted to see Debbie Allen's work outside of Grey's Anatomy, because she's a showrunner of Grey's Anatomy, or producing director of Grey's Anatomy. And I really wanted to see more of her work. And she had this documentary on Netflix called Something Dreams, Hot Chocolate Nutcracker. Dance Dreams or something like that. Look it up. It's fabulous. Anyway, it was a documentary about a school that she started in Los Angeles for Black ballerinas, for making the nutcracker, but with all Black dancers or people of color. And there I spotted this young ballerina named Savoy Bailey. And I was like, wow, that ballerina, she's so poised and she's a great dancer, which I understand, you know, success is transferable. So if you have that work ethic for dancing and movement, that means that you'd be good at blocking. And I just have to be good at directing the actor, and they have to be able to absorb that direction. And I always feel like dancers innately have that because so many of my friends who've been Broadway dancers are fantastic actors like Rosa Redondo and just so many great people. Anyway, so she was on my list and she auditioned for the lead as well. And she was on my deck and she wasn't right for the lead. And she didn't have the craft of the other actors, but there was something about her that stood out. And I thought, let me try her for this other part, the second lead. And she nailed it. She was so good at it. And every day that I worked with her on set, she became stronger and stronger. And it turns out that her mom is actually a well-known actor who's been acting forever. So she must get some of that from her mom, but she also took great direction. She always knew her lines. She was very easy to work with. And those are the things that matter. And I do believe that she's going to have an extraordinary career moving forward in the same way that Ken Condi will, who had the lead in it. So, yeah, and I love giving actors that opportunity. Maybe because I've been an actor who wanted that opportunity, so I know what it means. It means to them, it means to me as much as it means to them, for me to be able to show them and show them through my work and give them the opportunity to give me their best work, because that's exactly what I want from every actor, whether it be the lead or background actors. I make sure that I like talk to background actors and say, hey, I used to be a background actor. Let me tell you something. I need you. If you're not giving me the acting, people are going to see it and they're going to fall out of my story. So I need you to be there and be present for me, because background actors very much matter as well.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about success being transferable. Oh my goodness. That is key. I totally agree with you. I think there's always something we can use from a previous experience to bring it into another platform project or just different mindset to help us keep going. But I am curious though, what are some morning habits or routines that you implement to keep yourself on this successful trajectory?
I am part of a writer's group. I don't attend it every day, but it's available 5 days a week. And the way that it works is it starts at 9 a.m. and we enter the room. It's a Zoom room. It's a virtual room. And in 5 minutes, we all state our intention. And then a timer set for 50 minutes and we write for 50 minutes. And then we take a break for 5 minutes and then come back to it at 10. So we can do, we're on from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. So I always have a writer's room available to me Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And I can jump on for an hour. And there have been times that I've jumped on for the whole session for many times. You know, it depends on where I'm at with the work. So now I'm doing a little bit of rewriting something. I'm also working on another pilot. And it all goes by, what do I need to accomplish this day? Because I'm still running a casting office. I'm casting a commercial that takes place in Denver right now. I'm also casting something that I also might be directing that is partially taking place in Puerto Rico and another one in New Orleans. But these are like, these projects don't happen. One of them doesn't happen until October. The other one happens in September. So I'm still working my parallel track job. I still love it because casting is so great because then I'm able to give people opportunity, right? It's like I'm giving them money, opportunity, everything that they want in their career. And I get to tell them that they got the job, which I love that thing. Even if I'm telling the agent, like, hey, they got the job, like the agent cares too. So this is a habit that I do all the time, is just prioritize what needs to be accomplished. And then what else can I do? Like today, I'm actually doing this interview with you. But then this morning, I put together on my Instagram, Adeline Del Valle Director, I put together a series of like auditions that book. So in promoting my film coming out tomorrow, I've been showing the actors who audition for it their actual auditions and then followed by the trailer.
Wow.
So like that's something, and I consider that like a part of my work, right? Because I'm revealing the actor's audition, showing like talking about what I loved about it, and then promoting the film that's coming out while highlighting the actor and my work. So that's something that I did early this morning. And then now I'm talking with you, but before I was talking with you, I was actually doing an SRT file for my film Me 3.769 that's no longer on HBO. So I'm going to put it on Film Hub where people can see it, but I need to create closed captioning for it. So I'm creating the closed captioning for it now. And I'm almost done with the with putting it on, but it takes a while. So I do it over time. Things like that. Like I'm always busy working on something.
I know that Alejandro was loving what you just said because he is a writer, actually just started his publishing company. And I think I told you about the film that we had at Official Latino Festival. Alejandro was actually the writer of. So I know he loves hearing that you rely on that writer's room.
I love the Official Latino Film Festival created by Danny Hastings. Yes, yes. That's actually where my films got picked up.
Oh, wow. Our film won the LGBTQ Voices Award there.
That's wonderful. When? This year? I mean, this last year? Because I was here, I was there in December.
It was 2021.
Yeah, 2021. That was one of the films that I directed, I think I told you before. I totally swore off directing.
It's good to swear off of directing if you don't feel it. But I would continue to explore everything so that at least you know what it's like on the other side of things. And like, I found my passion in directing. That's, I have to say, I love every aspect of this media, even the technical side of it. But I love directing actors more than anything else. I love acting in films and being directed because I get to learn from those directors. Love the story of it all. I love grasping the story and keeping on track with the story because that's what a director really, that's the job of a director. Like you don't even have to know where to put a camera, although I consider it a big part of the job as well. I think what's more important is that you always know where you are in the story and where you're filming, that you're there to support your actors and that they can have the confidence that you're going to be there for them in the story, wherever it is. And that's, I can't tell you how much I love that.
I really admire this altruistic approach that you implement with filmmaking in all aspects of the process. I am so struck by the agility and the altruism.
Thank you.
It's truly admirable. It's amazing.
Well, I'm a pretty positive person. Yeah, I'm a pretty positive person. And I feel like people feel that and they feel my confidence. Like even what I just did with Brownsville Bread, you have to be resourceful as well. Be ready to take the no, but you have to see where there might be an opportunity to include someone and they might want it. So you have to not be such a negative Nelly and feel like, oh, everybody's going to say no to me. So I was having dinner with a friend of mine, brought me to this big holiday dinner. And I sat next to someone who said to me that they were renovating a building right now and they had, you know, it has multiple apartments. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm looking for a place with an apartment to film because I'm filming this thing. And he was like, oh, well, you know, you won't be interested in this building. It's kind of run down. It really needs everything. Like everything needs to be. I was like, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And then I took him out to lunch and I told him about the film and my passion as a filmmaker and how I was struggling financially to make this film, but that it was my big passion project. And he let me use 3 apartments.
Whoa.
In the same building. So one was always holding, one was always location, one was always like, and then, you know, we had to get a generator because the electricity was not the best, but, and we were visited like by the fire marshal, we were visited by NYPD, we were visited by SAG all the time. We always were doing everything on the level and right. Just, it was interesting because now that everything's on strike, as soon as a permit is pulled, everybody goes to it because that's where they have nothing else to do. And then I got a call from SAG saying like, so we heard that you were in Brownsville without police. I was like, I absolutely had police. You know, it was one day that we filmed in Brownsville. Not only did I have people playing as police, but I had not just the media and film and TV people, but I had the actual department of police because they were associated with the Tenants Association. And that Tenants Association and the buildings actually just awarded me, just gave me an award for the work that I do in the community where I was raised, Brownsville, Brooklyn. So everything is connected. And I was like, I could send you pictures of the entire police. Like there were like tens of police officers. And usually with the media and TV unit, it's only 2, but we had so many. And I felt anywhere I go as a producer, I'm always concerned about the safety of the environment for the people working under me. But especially in Brownsville, because I come from that, I understand the inherent dangers of being in a place like Brownsville. Yeah, so I was feeling the pressure of that and the responsibility of it, but we definitely had a lot of police and I was like so happy to tell SAG like, dude, I know. Like, but we only filmed there one day. It was only these hours. Nothing happened, no incidents. We had the police. So anyway, I digress.
Jumping into our DM questions, because we are damsels in the DMs, I am positive that there are many people in your DMs, Elaine, because I know that whenever we have casting directors on here, they always have funny stories to tell us about the many actors are soliciting them. So please tell us about the funniest, wildest, most intriguing, or inspirational DM that you have ever received.
Well, it's as a casting director, I could tell you as a, so it's always the same thing as I think it's awful that people will reach out to you and say, here I am, what do you have for me?
Oh.
So I always say, and I'm always very respectful and nice because people don't know. And I say, we put all of our castings on actorsaccess.com. When a role is right for you, that's the time to submit because that's what I'm looking for you. Good luck. Mm. And I really don't need to know anything more about you. I'm not going to keep files like I used to keep piles of headshots. I used to have baskets of piles of headshots all over my office, but I don't have to do that anymore because it's all on the casting platform. I talked about found that Kyle Kankandi, I found her because of the on point thing. So if you are on point keeping up with your platform, you know, your height, your weight, where you're from, your languages, your special skills. If I'm looking for you and you're hard to find, trust me, I'm going to find you. Mm-hmm. I even create on Instagram, like, I'm looking for this person. It's super hard to find. Please tell me if you know people like that, even if they're not actors. I had Daniel Tiger Neighborhood hired me to, I'm the casting director for Alma's Way, which is an animated series for PBS Kids and Fred Rogers Productions. We're about to have our second season premiere. The organization, Fred Rogers Organization, actually hired me for a Daniel Tiger Neighborhood when they couldn't find a 6 to 8 year old black male with autism authentically to play this character of Max. Their original casting director, I was like, tell me about what the search was like. And they said, well, she found 3 options. And I was like, you should kiss the ground she walks on. However, that said, you come to me, you know, I'm the needle in a haystack person all the time because I'm super resourceful looking for people and I have a lot of tentacles. Let me do what I do. And because I have a strong connection with the autism community, I really had no doubt that I was going to find who I was looking for. And we just need one, right? We just need one. That's what I just always remind a client. They like reached me a few days after I started the search and they were like, how's it going? How's it going? I was like, no, we're good. We're good. I had 38 amazing options, authentically autism, 6 to 8 year old African-American young boys. And of course we cast them and they were so happy with that. And I was super, super proud of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm always hit up for like, can I have a role? That's a silly question. The other thing that I get as a writer is like, I've got the best true story that you definitely want to make. And I'm like, there's a picture out there where like somebody's running after someone else and the other person's like that. And they say like, that's the person who says they have the best story that you want to make. And that's the writer and filmmaker going, go away, leave me alone. Because that's sort of disrespectful and unknowing of the process that takes so long. You have to have so much passion driving to complete any project. Why would I choose yours? What, I mean, that's just so insane that you would think that. That's, I mean, it doesn't matter what the story is. There's, I could rip from the headlines and choose 20 stories like that. So it's all wild when people just don't respect the process or understand, and or understand that actors who are well-crafted, who spent years training and studying that on the craft that they can rely on, that you could just say, I'm pretty, come look at me. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't float with any casting director that I know.
Well, with your tentacles on the pulse, please help us and our listeners keep our fingers on the pulse with how we can stay updated on your work, where we can remind us again, where we can see the film that's coming out on Tubi tomorrow.
Definitely go to Tubi. It's called Midnight Hustle. Tubi is a free platform. So it has, you know, it has ads. So you could, it's downloadable for free. And then, so definitely follow me, Elaine DeVaya Director. You can watch all, watch the self-tape videos that booked, the auditions that booked. I have a whole series on that there. And also have DeVaya Casting, at DeVaya Casting on Instagram as well. I'm mostly on Instagram and I really do answer all the questions that come at me. And I take it very seriously, everything that I do and people that I connect with. And because, you know, your name is everything.
Where can we find a Brownsville Bread, the novel?
And where can we find about Brownsville Bread? So definitely brownsvillebread.com. You can see the trailer. Brownsville Bread is in born and bred, not the bread that you eat. So Brownsville, BRED.com. And there's where you could see the trailer to the first part and some behind the scenes footage to the first part. And I'll be uploading some more of the second part where you can donate and find out where to buy the book. You can buy the book on Amazon. Yeah, and just follow me on Instagram because I'm very careful about the things that I post there. And if I post it, then I want you to see it. And I think that it's of value.
Elaine, thank you so, so much for being here. Truly, you are such an inspiration to me. And I know to the many other people listening.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. And good luck with your films.
Thank you. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Damsels in the DMs.
This has been an amazing experience. Don't forget to hear more exciting pieces of feedback or advice that you might want in your career or in any sort of creative endeavor that you're pursuing. Let us know. We have a whole toolkit, a whole treasure chest of amazing individuals who have the insights and have the expertise to be able to help you along your path. So write to us, DM us, send us a voicemail if you want. We're always open.
Yes. And we're going to be implementing a new expert segment. So let us know what you need help with and we will find the expert to bring you that information. We're going to be rolling that out in the next few episodes. So stay tuned and please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you may listen to your podcast. That allows us to continue bringing you new content.
We love to hear it. We love to see it. And we're excited to bring you new content always.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Damsels in the DMs.
Until next time.
It's going down in the DMs.
Bye. Bye.
'Em's DMs, yeah, we see 'em, yeah, we read 'em. DMs, DMs, we don't need 'em, we just leave 'em.
Please. Yeah.
It's going down in the DMs. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.